Hey everyone, this is Sadia Khan and you're listening to Immigrantly. I hope you guys are washing your hands and social distancing. I am recording this episode in April and I'm hoping when I release it in May, things will be much better. But right now I have newfound appreciation for little things in life that people take for granted. For instance, today I am craving bubble tea, but I'm also grateful and I realize that I am privileged to be able to stay home, cook, relax, while there are so many people on the front lines who are literally risking their lives to save ours. So a shout out to all of them, doctors, nurses, grocery store workers, emergency crew, thank you for what you're doing. We are better because of you. Stay safe. And now to our today's guest, Iram Parveen Bilal. She is a creator, a physics Olympian turned filmmaker. She wears 8 rings on her body and appreciates honesty. She is an enabler who focuses on thought-provoking stories that are socially impactful and envision an inclusive world. This is how Iram describes herself. When someone uses these words to describe themselves, you know that the art they produce is going to be interesting and thought-provoking, to say the least. And what more could you expect from someone who believes that genuine curiosity is the antidote to fear? Iram's films have addressed a lot of issues like feudalism, youth movements, cultural stigma, generational ties, and poverty. Her latest film is I Will Meet You There. I've watched this film and I loved it. It's a story that follows the father-daughter journey of Majid, a Chicago policeman, and Dua, his teenage ballerina daughter, as he goes undercover in a mosque for a special FBI assignment. Here to speak with us today is Iram Parveen Bilal.
Shooting in Pakistan is like a dream. Filmmaking is my passion, but I'm so happy when I'm doing it in Pakistan. Because it's just, you know, what I absolutely love, and these days my thoughts are really with them, is like the day laborers and sort of like the frontline people, you know, the boy who'll bring your chai and you know, the darzi, and the, like, they're just so sweet.
Thank you so much, Iram, for coming on my podcast.
Yes, I'm so excited to chat with you. I've heard such good things about your podcast from Sheetal. I'm here for you. Khuli kitab.
So let's start with your film, I'll Meet You There. I watched it and I loved it. And I have so many questions about the movie itself. But it was supposed to premiere at South by Southwest Festival. Unfortunately, it was cancelled due to the pandemic. So what is the status now?
You know, I was just having a chat with an ex-European sales agent who's now a consultant and consulting producer. Everybody just keeps using the same words, unprecedented, we have no idea, everything is on hold. And it just seems like such a doomed world. And especially for somebody who's been working on a project for 10 years. I mean, this was that passion project that, you know, I have to make it. So it was like, wo wali film jo banani hai na, kuch bhi ho, marne se pehle banani hai. It was that personal film that, you know, I was just stubborn, kidding, I have to make this. And it took so long and it was so impossible to make because it was such a niche personal story. So getting financing, getting distributed, everything has been challenging. So something like South by Southwest narrative competition, like the odds are 0.07%. I actually calculated them. To get into that level was like a dream for an independent filmmaker because it is the best launch. I mean, short of Sundance, like, so Sundance and South by are like considered two of the best festivals in the US, and then Tribeca. And to be in that, one of 10 films in competition, like, it's the best shot you can have, like, towards, you know, just the buzz and then possibly a great sales. And it was so close, you know, we were 6 days away from it. And I had just had my first child. So I was actually through postpartum figuring out the delivery of the film and everything you know, somehow magically I had done it. And then, you know, that week was like a week from hell because it felt like you had a relative in the ICU and you knew they were going to pass away because it was like every day, oh, Facebook pulled out, everyone's texting me. And I'm like, I've read the news. I just don't want to believe it. Just stop telling me this. And, you know, quietly the other competition directors were reaching out to each other on social media and being like, hey, I've got like this pit in my stomach. I'm so scared. I was so anxious. Every morning I would wake up with my stomach like just very uneasy because I had a feeling, you know, but I thought that they would just still go ahead. Even when they kept saying we're going ahead, part of me was also really just upset because with all these buyers pulling out, great, you have a festival, but it's just a party at that point, right? And even that, it's like, okay, fine, for my cast and crew, you know, Kavi Khan, we were trying to get him from Pakistan. We had like a whole day press junket lined up. We had such good like press. I had galvanized the local Austin community. We were going to be sold out. We had an after party. We'd, you know, booked Airbnbs, all the cast was coming. So much of the crew was coming. And you know, part of me was uneasy. And I was thinking, I was telling my husband, I was like, you know, maybe we shouldn't take the baby, you know. It started becoming this like anxiety thing just to get it over with now. Instead of like a party that we would want to enjoy, it became this anxiety thing like, okay, fine, let's just get it over with. So I actually remember when I found out the news for a moment, you know, it was devastating, but there was also this strange relief lurking around. Maybe it was the right thing. And then obviously just even that week, it was such a long week, but at the end of the week, it did feel like they had made the right decision.
So you're talking about the decision being right because of the pandemic, the health reasons, right? So you wrote this really raw and emotional essay for Filmmaker magazine after the premiere was cancelled. And I'll just quote you here that indie filmmakers are, in your words, the hidden collateral damage in face of politics, finance, and public health. What do you wish that people who are outside of the industry would understand about emotional work that goes into being an indie filmmaker?
You know, when this cancellation happened, people were like, oh, you'll get another festival. Oh, you know, it's okay. Like, they just couldn't quite grasp. The reason I wrote that op-ed is because I started realizing that it's so difficult to grieve for something when other people don't understand what you've lost. As it is, like when some, you know, when people, even God forbid, when you lose a loved one, people say, oh, I understand, and they've not lost a loved one. That in itself is something else. But then it is, this is very particular because until and unless you're an indie filmmaker, you don't know. Because here's what it is, Sadia, like you work for years, okay, like an average independent film, when I talk to people, 3 years, 5 years, 7 years, 10 years, because it takes so long to get financing, because even making the cheapest film is so expensive. And then trying to sell it and trying to get it out into the world, because the film business is a mafia, right? I mean, it's run by conglomerates and studios who control everything from like inception of idea all the way to distribution chains as well. So it's like, you as an indie filmmaker really have a shot. Like there's only few entryways for you to make your career from like indie to like be actually seen. You spend majority of your life being unseen. Like, you know, when you talk to like a random like small town barber, if you're traveling on a road trip, or like a convenience store person, you, when you say you're a filmmaker, they say, oh, what is it? And you just smile at them because they think that, you know, if you say the name of your film, they would recognize it. Well, we're dealing with a market of surplus. It's not like I'm making a Marvel film that like I'll talk to somebody on a road trip, you know, passing through Kansas, and they will know what my film is. It's like just the disconnect between audiences and what they understand are the troubles of making films and the actual process of making films. This notion that like filmmakers are like rich and famous and that like they would have heard of a film. You understand that there is such a gap in understanding of the reality of the economics of the film business and how impossible it is to even get to a point to be at a showcase where people would have heard. At least now with South By's name, I feel like at least the Desi diaspora in Pakistan or in America, I'm hoping would have heard of my film, but I don't know. All I know is I have to work really hard. Like, you know, my first film when I was distributing it, I was literally like going through Yellow Pages in Sacramento, calling up every like Desi store and putting flyers up so people would come to the screening of my film. Like, it's just soup to nuts. Like, there is struggle at every phase. There is nothing where like people are coming to you. It's always push, push, push.
How receptive is Desi community to Desi indie filmmakers?
I mean, it's difficult. Again, I think that the other notion is that a lot of independent filmmakers, the topics that they can afford, right? So it's a cause and effect thing. A lot of filmmakers, just because it's a very competitive field, are not probably greenlit by the studios because they're just a supply and demand nature, but also the type of stories they want to tell, like I'll Meet You There, are very sort of raw slice of life films, and studios, for whatever reason, will not put their money behind it because their metrics say that these are not the films that make a lot of money. And so because of that, it's a vicious cycle. The films they put out are the films that reach the vast, you know, sort of majority of audiences. So then they're used to watching that. Like, so our crowd, what Hollywood does, that's what Bollywood does. So a lot of Desi crowd is just used to masala big films. Even in Pakistan, that's the issue now, is like the films that make it to the big theaters and that the television studios will put their force behind are films that are just these, you know, sort of big performance pieces. They're not necessarily focus on like character driven stories. So that is why the diaspora also kind of doesn't understand how to process these films. But I will say that once they come to the theater, most of them leave really happy. With me, at least, because I did so much work with Josh, I know that with this film, inshallah, let's hope things calm down. My plan is that Q3, Q4 this year to travel with it in America, is I'll do a theatrical myself. If we don't get a theatrical distributor, I'll go, because I am now building on this audience that I already had for Josh. And this is a, you know, I think it's a better film. It's made in English as well. So like even, you know, the younger crowd that's born, brought up in the US, hopefully will connect with it.
It's a great film. In fact, let's talk about I'll Meet You There. Now, what I witnessed was there were a number of thematic issues that you addressed. There was issue of generational patterns and familial ties, which was at the crux of the film. And the character Doa, she's following in the footsteps of her mother, and then she has this newly ignited relationship with her grandfather, who's played by Kavi Khan. By the way, his acting was impeccable. I was so impressed with him. Like, I'm sure you and I both grew up watching him in Urdu dramas, but he did such a wonderful job. What message did you want to share about the way families create their stories throughout generations?
I think the message, if there is one specifically in I'll Meet You There, is a message of acceptance. I think that we all live our own realities, and we all have our own baggage. We all have our own interpretation of ideology and the rules of the world, and the rules of books and the rules of God. And I think that in some space, that's why this film is called I'll Meet You There, based on the great Jalaluddin Rumi's quote. We need to understand to accept and coexist. We need to understand that everything is a shade of gray. And we need to sort of, you know, proceed with that level of uncertainty and acceptance in our surroundings. And that not just, it's not just a, you know, a family like a grandfather, father and a daughter, as is in the case of this film. It's a larger conversation, which is why I feel this film is universal, is that it's a conversation between communities, between nationalities, between us versus them and whatever we classify as other, is that there is always enough commonality to sort of meet somewhere in the middle. And that was it. I mean, that's the message. To me, the message of I'll Meet You There is that you should be okay to represent who you are and what your emotional truth is to your family, and your family should accept you. There's so much hurt that comes from a lot of especially Asian sort of households where, you know, we hide who we really are, you know, whether it's like a sexuality issue or a love issue or a, you know, like career choice issue or a faith issue, that we are so worried about being judged and being sort of not loved anymore. I think at the heart of it, it's about being loved. Everybody wants love, and love is one of the best forms of acceptance, right? And so that's, I think, what the film really tries to talk about, is I can still love you, I can still accept you, you can still exist even if we're not on the same page.
That's true. But you also demonstrated kind of, I would say, tension between individualistic versus collectivist societies, right? Expectations of grandfather versus granddaughter, based on where they grew up and how they envisage or envision family ties. So it was an extremely interesting mix of two cultures and two societies, because most of the time we think that two cultures, Western and Eastern cultures, are at odds. But in this, it was a great mesh of two cultures. And especially the relationship between Dua and her grandfather was so rich and so interesting. As I was watching it, I wished my kids had that kind of relationship with their grandparents, because obviously my parents live in Pakistan, my husband's parents live in Pakistan. It is not as strong a relationship. What was going through your mind, Iram, when you were creating these characters?
First of all, thank you for connecting with the film on that level. I think so much of your own experience as a filmmaker goes into your films, right? The conversations about dance and Islam come from a very personal point in my life. My sister, who taught me how to dance, now thinks that music and dance are in some form of fashion haram. And that's fine. That's her journey. That's her belief. And I respect her. But, you know, there's a lot of things I want to say to her that I can't. And, you know, so I think Dua and Baba kind of externalize that. There is so much of, like, my parents, my dad and Baba, there's so much of, you know, when Majid says, oh, I'm still answering questions with questions, that's my mother. If you ask her a question, she will always be like, why are you asking this question? To try and figure out what your motives are. There's so much takalluf in, like, a Desi family, and so much sort of layering. Brown people never say what they mean. It's true. It's because we have so much tehzeeb around, like, what should be said, what shouldn't be said, out of respect and out of boundaries. And there's just a lot of boundaries, actually, in our culture, right? So a lot of that came in. And then specifically the cop situation is, like, I remember after 9/11, I was at some sort of community fundraiser, and I remember seeing this complete orthodox Muslim, like, dadiwala guy in LAPD uniform. And I just couldn't get him out of my head. And I was like, wow, what an interesting, weird situation to be in the world we live in right now. And so I think that always lingered in my head. And so at some point, the project essentially became an ensemble piece where I just wanted to dive into what life is like in post 9/11 Muslim communities. You know, people don't understand that within the Muslim community, there's been such a fracturing. Pre 9/11, I felt like being Muslim was just a part of, like, your life. It wasn't like called to question, acha ji, what type of Muslim are you? Like, when everybody looked at you like, oh, you're Muslim, you suddenly were an expert in the room, and you had to be like, okay, well, I didn't take my religion that seriously. How much do I believe? What do I believe? People became extremely conservative. Some people threw their hijabs off. It was just like a whole crazy, like, there was a spotlight and everybody was just like a deer in headlights, and they had to figure out, okay, you know, so there was a lot of fracturing in the community. There's this whole movement of reclaiming Islam, like this Protestant movement, and then there's this whole backlash where people have become very sort of strict, stringent, born-again Muslims, and the rest of the world doesn't know what all this sociopolitics has done to the community. And so in some form or fashion, that was kind of important to have a conversation on as well.
But in addition to that, you were also trying to address some stereotypes, because there is one conversation that Dua has with her father about treatment of women in Islam, and you debunk a myth that is what's written in Quran about beating women. But you do it in such a subtle way that it doesn't come across as preachy. It is just a conversation bit that, you know, anybody can understand or relate to.
Why did Khatak kill Ma?
Judgments were crippling.
Who judged her? Baba?
He's not the man I knew once, okay?
Started reading the Quran today.
What did you read?
The verse about striking women.
Chapter 4, verse 34. You know, the word strike is misinterpreted as heading. It actually means to go and strike.
Was that a conscious effort on your part to debunk those stereotypes and narratives around Islam?
I was a little worried because, you know, I'm no scholar, and I had a bunch of scholars actually read the script because I knew that I was talking about verses from the Quran, and I wanted to make sure, you know, at one level, it's a character. Any character can have any point of view, but people just go up in arms when you were talking about anything remotely religious. So I really, like, I had a bunch of, this was actually a suggestion from a scholar that I had spoken to. And I said, yeah, it's very important to me that I'm not trying to be that filmmaker who's just, like, you know, slashing anyone who's religious. Like, I didn't want it to be that, which is why I wanted to show that, you know, yes, the Quran is misinterpreted. Sure, there might also be things in the Quran that, you know, one of the characters doesn't agree with. And that's their reality. You know, so it, I wanted to have shades of gray everywhere. So yes, it was very intentional. I didn't, you know, I don't say whether dance is haram or halal. Like, it does not say. The film doesn't have one point of view. It has two points of view. And it's like, you, the audience, should decide who you really agree with, you know. So, yes, it was important to me. And it was important to kind of also kind of gesture towards, yes, there are certain things that are misinterpreted. You know, the meaning of jihad is misinterpreted. It's interesting. A lot of people, Paul Feig just saw the film and I was honored that he saw, he loved it. And he said, you know, I've learned so much in just 90 minutes.
That's what I was going to say. I think for a Western audience, it is such an interesting film and it's done so brilliantly that if somebody were to learn something or take away from it, it won't come across as boring or preachy, but just, you know, part of the conversation.
Yeah, I really hope so, Sadia. I mean, inshallah, my dream is to really travel with the film and engage, but it's heartbreaking. I don't even know if there's any space for that dreaming right now, you know, so I just must quietly wait. Is film ke saad, I mean, sabr has been a big thing. I mean, it has been, this film has been doomed from the beginning. I mean, we lost the financing twice. We were just, we've shot it in 18, 19 days. It's just been so, which is why I think that the result of South By was like such a, oh my God, you know, it all paid off. And then this happened. So we just kind of like, I'm just moving forward. I'm working on something else. Thankfully, I'm right now being paid to write. And I'm just trying not to think about it because it hurts so much when I go down that rabbit hole. I think it's an important film. And I personally think it's really going to resonate because when we had test screenings, I had people. And so for me, it was very important not to, because my first film, Josh, really just related with like people of your generation who came from Pakistan and had the nostalgia factor. But I felt that I wasn't able to connect with, like, I guess it's called the first generation, the people who were born here. And so this film was very important to me because I sent it to a bunch of specific people in the test screening phase. And these girls called me. These are girls who grew up here. And they said, this was my story. And she said, I couldn't stop crying. She said, I relate to that scene where he says, you haven't read the Quran, like, in such a sweet but judgmental manner. There were so many people who said, this is my story. And I was so excited. I was like, okay, this is going to be great because we're going to have, and actually people across cultures, you know, this film has, one of the co-producers is Jewish. One of the co-producers is a Baptist, raised Baptist. Heather Ray comes from an indigenous culture. It's like fully, like, very sort of diverse religions. A lot of women in the crew. And all these people related. Like, I remember when we were shooting the raid scene, like, just when I was just rehearsing, like, my ADs were coming shuddering and crying. They're like, I can't watch this. And I said, well, this is how brutal it is. And they're like, it's so brutal just in this acting, just while we're rehearsing it. I can't even imagine what it is. But it's true. I mean, these things happen. So
why did you choose Chicago, by the way? Because I would have assumed it would either be LA or New York, but you chose Chicago. Was there any significance of the location itself?
So we actually shot the film in New York for Chicago. So I'm glad we fooled you.
So I kept on thinking it looks, and then I was like, no, it says Chicago. So it must be Chicago.
No, we actually had a second unit go and film in Chicago. So there's a bunch of stuff that is Chicago. Well, the reason is, you know, New York, it becomes very, oh, 9/11 baggage. And LA, we don't have, like, it's a very dispersed sort of community, you know, like LA is very sort of just, you don't have that sort of the feel of the streets that you have. We filmed this on Jackson Heights or Divan. Chicago was important for me for two reasons. I feel like there's a lot of segregation of community in Chicago. I feel like New York and LA in some ways still is. Yes, you have like your little Ethiopia and you have like Koreatown and little Tokyo, but people are somehow a little more mixy. And same with New York, it's a melting pot. But Chicago has a strange, you know, there's a lot of segregation still, the police corrupt culture, like it's just known a lot for that. Also, I just didn't want it to be like, oh, this is just a coastal issue. Like, this is happening with immigrant communities, you know, throughout America. And when you choose a Midwestern town, it somehow becomes more relatable to, like, you can extrapolate it to small town America, even though Chicago by no means is a small town America. And also, like, I remember the first time I went to Divan, I fell in love with it. That was the first sort of Desi community I'd seen. Also, Chicago is historically one of the biggest Desi hubs, right, in America.
Let's pivot a little, Iram. Let's talk about your personal life. So you grew up in Pakistan and Nigeria. Can you talk a little bit about that? And how often did two cultures conflict?
I mean, the thing is, you know, we grew up in Nigeria, but, you know, my parents are both Pakistani and I left Nigeria when I was 8. Like, at the same time, I feel that I'm, you know, what they call a third culture kid. Like, I just, my ideas, my sort of cultural viewpoints are so international at this point in my life, because I've spent like a decade or more of my life, like a third of my life I've spent in, you know, in different countries. Each third has been in a different continent. And at some point, I think with sort of globalization, things become so international, you know. I mean, my core is Pakistani because that's what my ethnicity is. And I grew up in Pakistan, you know, from the age of 8 all the way to like college age. And so that's when you really form a lot of, you know, cultural nuances. And, you know, my family still is in Pakistan. It's not like, you know, we've all immigrated to America. I came here for college and then I stayed behind. So I'm Pakistani. That's who I am. I was born in the US, so I have a US passport, but I'm actually dual, you know, national. I was not raised here. My parents were doing their education and then they moved back to Nigeria where they were. And then we finally moved to Pakistan when my parents lost their life savings at the BCCI bank crash. Mm-hmm. And so then we grew up in Pakistan, and I would never trade that for anything, you know, learning to read and write Urdu. I spoke Urdu, but I didn't know how to read and write it. But then I went to Pakistan. My first film, Josh, I remember typing the entire script in translation in Urdu myself because I wanted to make sure that kisi random house translation na ho, that the script is a blueprint. I'm Pakistani. I would say I'm Pakistani. I bleed green.
But does it change over the years? Because I have mentioned this in my previous interviews as well. When I came to the US, I was more Pakistani and not American at all. Like, I did not even know what that meant. And now it's been more than a decade. And now I am at a point where I am both Pakistani and American, but I feel like I relate to, or I consider myself more of a Muslim American than Pakistani. Maybe because I feel like I'm living through my kids now. Like, when I see them, I see what they like, what they don't like, what are their passions, how they approach life. It's influenced me a lot as well. Do you think it changes? I mean, there is a part of me which will always be Pakistani. And that nostalgia, that love for Pakistan will never go away. But what I'm saying is that it has become more balanced now than when I came here initially.
I mean, of course, I think that your identity always changes in life. It's such a combination of your experiences. As much as we talk about labels, I also kind of dream of a world where I don't have a label. When I say I bleed green, it's not a nationalistic sort of thing. It's more just that's, you know, like the smells and the sounds. Like, I'm very desi. And I mean, like, anywhere in South Asia, I immediately feel like, okay, it's home, you know. When I landed in Colombo, it felt like home. Or, you know, being even backpacking through India, it feels so similar. And I guess that part of it is, like, culturally, I'm very desi. The food, the music, the shairi, the clothes, the mehndi.
Yeah, and when I go back to Pakistan and I go to bazaar and they call me Baji, I love it. I miss that so much. I'm like...
Shooting in Pakistan is like a dream. Filmmaking is my passion, but I'm so happy when I'm doing it in Pakistan because it's just, you know, what I absolutely love, and these days my thoughts are really with them, is like the day laborers and sort of like the frontline people, you know, the boy who'll bring your chai and you know, the darzi, and like, they're just so sweet and so nice and so humble. And so there's this sort of weird sort of brotherhood, sisterhood, camaraderie, respect in our culture, hospitality, friendship, that is just sort of unrivaled, you know, and it comes from the old world. So to answer your question, I think we're just like chameleons, you know. When we are dropped in one place, we actually are, it's a strength. Like, you know, people have, I don't like how in the industry in Pakistan, there's always this like, oh, like, they always want to say I'm Pakistani-American. And I'm like, no, I'm Pakistani. I live in America. You know, wanting to always make you feel like an outsider. And I'm just kind of like, no, like, we actually have all this strength. Like, in America, I can survive in America. In Pakistan, I can survive in Pakistan. You know, I'm somebody who grew up in, like, you know, my father's side was very, very sort of modest financially. We're middle-class people. And it's like, I'm comfortable eating on the floor, sitting on a charpai. And I'm also comfortable pitching to, like, an investor in Burj, Dubai. You know, that's who I am. And I take that as a strength. I don't take it as a weakness. Okay, oh, I'm going to hide. Okay, you know, my dada left everything in India during partition and had an auto mechanic workshop. That's my background. You know, my nana was a postmaster. You know, they were these really wealthy people in India who left everything in partition and had to rebuild up. To me, that's strength. That's not weakness. And if anything, in this world order, we're realizing that the people who know how to build themselves up back from scratch, that's the biggest strength. And so this whole, like, conversation about sort of, that's the other thing. It's like, I think you can be everything at once. And, like, you know, I'm married to a Caucasian and my daughter, and they'd be like, oh, it's going to be so difficult. How are you going to raise her? What is she going to be? And I said, you know what? She's going to be stronger for the, you know, combination of these genes. She's going to have access to like the old world and the new world, to Asia and to America. You know, if anything, biology has shown us that when you mix genetics, you form like even stronger sort of, you know, gene pools. And so we need to learn from that. If you know, science is very beautiful. It has a very sort of objective way of stating the truths of our world. And just look at that. Like if you mix two gene pools, you make a stronger, more surviving sort of individual. What does that tell us? That tells us that we need to all meld and unite, and that's how we will be stronger. Like if we mix our cultures and our strengths and who we are, we will actually have a more diverse sort of outlook on life, a stronger, more foolproof way to sort of fight, whether it's a virus or, you know, fight, I don't know, whatever the enemy might be in the future.
Let's talk about science. So you came to the U.S. to do your bachelor's in environmental science engineering. How did you go from that to film? And does your background help you as a filmmaker?
Let me answer the second question first. I think that everything in your life, your life experience helps you as a filmmaker. I think science in some very interesting way has helped me in terms of my analytical skills, in terms of how I see story structure. I'm an engineer and there's I'm very fast with story structure. Things are like easy for me that way. I'm not worried about tech on set. Like I'm not like worried about talking about depth of field and like wide angles and like, you know, longer lenses and, you know, wide lenses. Like I'm not uncomfortable around technology. I taught myself how to edit and I edit now. Like it's not, software is not difficult for me. As far as, you know, I grew up in a house where my mother is a physicist. In fact, like in the 70s, my mom and her like five other sisters and her brother were all like scientists, like botanists, physicists. My mamu went to McGill for his PhD in the 70s. So in the 70s, for Pakistani women to all have their masters, I mean, that was actually anywhere in the world, that was pretty amazing. So I come from a lot of education on my mom's side. And my dad was a chemistry professor. So science was a big part in the family, you know. And I was Pakistan's first physics Olympiad girl. I qualified for the Asian Physics Olympiads. And then I got into Caltech. And at that point, Caltech was like number one in the world. And so it was like, oh, of course I'm coming. But then when I came here, it was so brutally science. And I thought of like, oh, America, you know, lockers and like, you know, jocks and cheerleaders. Yeah, well, Caltech was nothing like that. Very sort of, you know, my first summer, I was in the sub-basement, not even the basement, like putting these like DNA strands on semiconductor chips and baking them in the scanning electron microscope looking at them in the scanning electron microscope. And I just was like, what is this? You know, I just kind of immediately saw what cutting edge science would be like and what the life would be like. And frankly, it just was not glamorous enough for me. Somebody who had grown up on Bollywood and come from a culture that was so loud and colorful. Like I needed people around me. And I just immediately was like, I'm good at science, but this is not what I'm passionate about. And I had grown up on Bollywood. My parents are huge Bollywood fans. Like in Nigeria, I remember they told me the story that when Silsila came out, the theater was sold out, but they stood and watched the whole film. And we used to have this like closet of VHSs in our house. You know, old VHSs, this like Nigerian guy would get us these like bootleg copies of Bollywood films, and mama and daddy would, you know, sort of screen them before showing them to my sisters and I. And I would kind of climb in bed and pretend I was sleeping, but watch the whole film with them and then watch it again with my sisters. And even as young as like, whatever, 5, 6, I remember ke mujhe sare dialogues yaad the. I would just memorize dialogue, like not like intentionally, but they would just sit in my brain. And so when I think about, you know, when I write personal statements for grants and stuff, it goes back to how early that was, which is that I loved storytelling. I was obsessed with Shah Rukh Khan. My production company is called Parveen Shah Productions, where Shah is for Shah Rukh. Parveen is for my mom.
Oh, wow.
So grew up in Bollywood, loved it. So when I was at Caltech, I was like, you know what? And I love dance. Dance is my first passion, actually. But, you know, there's just no way I was going to be a professional dancer coming from sort of a middle-class Pakistani household. And so at Caltech, I basically did everything I could. And during the summers, applied for all these things. And I got this grant where I was allowed to go to England. And there I took a digital production class in the summer. And then, you know, I applied to film school and applied to the Watson Fellowship, which is a travel grant, and applied to like these consulting companies, you know. I got all three of them, and that's when I made a decision that I was just going to go travel for a year and then deferred my film school application. But it was really, honestly, it was out of ignorance in some ways. Like, it was just like something I really loved and I kind of fell into it.
What was your parents' reaction?
I mean, my mom freaked out, not only because of what I was thinking, but also just she was like, this is so expensive. You're going to take all these loans because, you know, we couldn't afford to film school. And for her, it was her immediate concern was like, oh my God, that means you're never going to come back to Pakistan because you're going to take these loans and then you're going to try and get a job to pay these loans. And so that was the first thing. And then I was traveling. I ended up doing the Watson. I was traveling around the world and asking people why they dance. And that actually found its roots back in some ways to this film. And during that, I remember my mom praying that I got the Watson Fellowship just so that, you know, film school ka bhoot utar jayega sar se. And much to her chagrin, I reapplied the next day and I got in. And I went to USC Film School for my master's. So their reactions were very, like, honest. Like, parents just want their kids to do well, right? And so she said that you are going into a profession that's all about... I mean, she was very perceptive, like, for not being in the arts. She said, listen, it's all about who you know and about being rich. And she said, I guarantee you we're not rich and we don't know anybody in this business. And she was absolutely right. I mean, a lot of my struggles have been trying to, you know, buy trust of the rich community, even here in America, like... You know, in the middle of a pitch, they'll ask you what your last name is. What does your dad do? Are you married?
Wow. So, Iram, who are your artistic influences?
Like, I'm not a filmmaker who, like, you know, really, like, follows one filmmaker and really watches and studies their work. I've never been that person. Like, and maybe it's arrogant, but I don't feel like, oh, you have to, like, love Godfather or you have to watch all these films before you decide to become a filmmaker. But some people who I really, really love are, you know, I love Wong Kar-wai's work. In the Mood for Love is one of my favorite films. Mm. But then, like, Richard Linklater's Before Sunrise is a favorite of mine. I like Michael Winterbottom's work. I love Danny Boyle's work. I love Nicole Holofcener's work here in the US. I love Frida by Julie Taymor. So there's just varying things. I love Meera Nair. So if you could say there's one person I really, like, look up to, it's Meera's work. I just love how she makes films. They're so, like, just flavorful. So, yeah, I mean, I would say just a bunch of filmmakers. You know, but grew up on Yash Raj. There's a lot of types. Like, I love Bollywood, but I don't see myself ever making, like, a full-on, like, Bollywood spectacle. Like, a Ye Jivani Hai Diwani. That's just not who I am. But, you know, so I go anywhere from, like, gritty. Like, I love... Like, just, you know, Delhi Crime on Netflix. I love that type of stuff. I love Succession. I love Delhi Crime. I love The Crown. I love Handmaid's Tale. So it's like all these palettes of very sort of strict drama thriller.
That's what you like.
And that's what I like. But I love grit. I mean, I love foreign film. I'm a big fan of, like, Iranian cinema, Turkish cinema.
You know, I feel like I should watch more international cinema. I don't do that, which is unfortunate. I watch Hollywood and Bollywood and then Lollywood, but that's it. I should, you know, expand my horizon when it comes to...
Bong Joon-ho said, you know, the moment you get over that 2-inch barrier of subtitles, like, you will open yourself to, like, a world that's incredible. Like,
yeah. I mean, Parasite is a great example of that. I watched it and I was floored. It's such a good movie. So, Iram, recently there has been this general wave of British Pakistani representation in the arts with films like Blinded by the Light and now Riz Ahmed's The Long Goodbye. What do you think are main differences between, say, British Pakistani and, I don't want to use the term American Pakistani, Pakistani-American, because you just pointed that out, but yeah, experiences that people may not know of.
You know, I mean, it all goes back to patterns of immigration, right? I had actually at some point, I have this series that I'm very excited about that's based on Mirpuris in England. But, you know, it's just so difficult again because everybody thinks like, oh, but you're living in America and why are you doing this British story? It's like, why can't? Story is a story. But in this day and age, it's so important that, you know, people like your bio needs to fit where the stories are coming.
What fascinates you about Mirpuri's story?
To answer your question, like, does the demographics of who went to Europe or England versus the demographics of who came to America defines the type of storytelling, right? I mean, the people who went to England in the 50s, 60s, 70s were a lot of villagers. So, you know, the parents are villagers and the kids have gone to Oxford and Cambridge. So it's so much conflict there. You know, the parents forced all these arranged marriages for a lot of these kids. And so they're Like when you are talking to people in Manchester, Bradford, Birmingham, it's kind of like they go from like very posh English to like Tate Punjabi. People who came to America came from the cities.
And they were mostly professionals.
They were all professionals. So the craft coming actually from England, I think, is more interesting because they have more history to go on. They have been in that part, I would say 20 to 30 years more than Pakistani Americans. So as a result, and the percentage representation is way higher. So they're also greenlit. The stories are greenlit more. Like it, people know what Pakistani is in England. In America, we're still very novel, right? I mean, in America, the model minorities are blacks and Latinos. Then it's starting to be East Asians, and then maybe it's us. They don't understand the difference between Indian and Pakistani, hence the jokes in the film.
You know, I always thought that model minority in America are East Asians.
Well, I guess like when you look at diversity fellowships or whatever, like immediately when you talk about diversity or color in America, it's black and Latino. Nobody thinks of us. Because we are somehow, we are very quiet. The Asian American generally, East Asian, South Asian, is a much quieter minority. We like to kind of go about our business. We come from a country and a place where it's like, you know, we just kind of want to go about our business, make our bills and be fine. So, and also I think that the oppression, it goes back to oppression. Like when you're very oppressed, then you sort of revolt, which is also why I think that the Pakistani community in England is different, is because they have had to see sort of like a harsh sort of racist reaction, you know, and they were doing sweat jobs. So that is why, that's the comparison I was trying to make. Whereas the community here is sort of rich and comfortable, very educated. From the highest income group is the Asian Americans in America, right? So because of that, there isn't this like, oh my God, you're so mean to us and you've not been like, you know, you're abusing our rights. So there isn't as much of a reaction. And in England, like, you know, I feel like there's always more Indians than Pakistanis just by nature of the population. But like Pakistanis have their own representation. In America, like when you think brown, like for South Asia, it's immediately just Indian. There is no room for Pakistan.
So on your website, you state that you think that genuine curiosity is the antidote to fear. Can you elaborate on that? What does that mean?
I mean, I think that sort of what I was saying earlier, like we need to not be scared of the other. If we genuinely want to understand and travel and learn, then we won't be scared of other people because we'll realize that there's nothing to be scared of. You know, there's so much common ground and there's so much beauty, even if they're different. And so by genuine curiosity, I mean like when you're actually interested in learning about other people, not for the sake of just, you know, pitching an idea for a script, but actually you want to know how they live, how they think, why they think the way they do. And then you understand. When you understand people, then you're not scared of them.
Iram, can you share what you're working on right now?
Well, I'm working on a series that I'm very excited about. I can't talk about it. I'm breaking this series that is set in South Asia that I'm super excited about. I have a project called Vakri in Punjabi. That means like Anokhi, like one of a kind. It was one of 15 projects selected at Cannes special market. They invite 15 mid-career directors and I was one of them. So I was very proud to represent Pakistan. That's inspired by Kandil Baloch. It is not about her, but it's inspired by her spirit. And so it's about an accidental social media star. We're hoping to shoot that end of next year. You know, everything is sort of like on hold and pushed because of this situation. So we're working on that on the feature side. And then I'm trying to get into the television space here in the US for writing and directing. I'm writing a thriller right now, which I'm very excited about. It's set in a very relevant space. Again, I can't talk about that more, but that's sort of my own passion project that I'm chipping away on. I wrote a television pilot on, it's about an ICE detention center. And it was about a Pakistani doctor who's thrown in and you try and understand why she's in there. And she meets a Mexican freedom fighter matriarch who's 9 months pregnant. It's about their sort of, it's called Detained. And so that has made a bunch of lists in Hollywood. You know, this was supposed to be a great time for me.
It still is, hopefully.
I was supposed to go into all these meetings and talk about I'll Meet You There and Detained and all these like, you know, amazing things in the work. But, you know, they're there, they're out there. People are reading them and watching and we're trying to do whatever we can. But I'm right now just focusing on writing and trying to get opportunities to meet showrunners virtually so that I can get some sort of directing jobs for television lined up.
That's wonderful. So in the end, if you were to describe America, how would you do that?
America is, it's an attempt for a society where we're not bogged down by tradition and rules. we can actually create and recreate ourselves. That's what I think the promise of the land is. But I think that very quickly, like at anywhere else, that promise of the land has changed. And now there are all these rules and there are these definitions of who is American and who isn't, and who's allowed and who's not allowed. But I think the beauty of this land is the possibility, and the possibility that you can go from rags to riches. It is still true. You know, it's not an aristocratic society like England or like a super sort of class system sort of place like Pakistan. So I think America is very much still a land of a land where you can redefine yourself, I would say. It's a land of ridding labels for new labels.
Thank you so much, Iram. This was wonderful. Best of luck. I can't wait to see all the projects that you're working on.
Inshallah. Thank you so much, Sadia. And I hope that we can talk to you again when we take the film out on the road.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you guys enjoyed Iram's interview. We are on Twitter and Instagram, and all of this information is on our website, which is immigrantlypod.com. Be sure to tune in next week. We have another incredible story. In the meantime, stay safe and distant.